Welcome to Gishmei Bracha. And the Gemara tells us that if there's a drought in Eretz Yisrael, which thank God this is not the case this year at all. I mean, we had some rain on Sukkot. That was just to remind us that it's on the way. And every year they worry that by the end of November it still hasn't rained yet, and then all of a sudden we get it, you know. So this is pretty much a pattern. So Baruch Hashem, the rains are coming. It rained pretty heavily in the north yesterday, in at least the western part of the north. And there's more to come. And the Mitzvah Shem will have adequate rainfall. But I always talk about the fact, and I think we've mentioned it here once, that with the development of desalinization plants, the pressure of having, you know, a good rain season is lessened, because we now can pump out water from the Mediterranean and convert it into drinking water. And we always had that technology, but just it was just ridiculously expensive. Israel is the first country to make it economically reasonable, and we now market that technology to the world. So it's really a Kiddush Hashem. But anyway, Gishmei Bracha is still a bracha, and we thank the Kiddush Baruch Hu. So the Gemara says that after a drought, and if it starts raining, so you have to have Birkat Hodaya. You have to thank the Kiddush Baruch Hu. And the expression of the bracha is Bodim Anachnu Lach Al Kol Tipa V'Tipa, on every drop. So you think about it, you know, what's a drop of rain? Drop of rain is not going to go anywhere. The other thing is that you can't get anywhere without the first drop and the next drop. And the drops just accumulate and become the rain that we want. And we should never think of just the end result, but also even the beginning, the first few drops, is also important. So, I mean, I'll give you just an example. You go to a basketball game, and the end of the game, the score is, you know, 105 to 102. Does anybody remember the first two baskets? Who cares? It was 2-0. It was 3-2, 4-3. You know, nobody's really into that game. The only time that it's even worthwhile watching a basketball game is the last 5 minutes. Because then, if it's close. And then it becomes an interesting game. But the truth is, in order to get 105 points, somebody had to hit the first basket. I mean, that's clear. So, the Kol Tipa V'Tipa. And more than that, the Rabbans explain that we basically thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu using the long form, not the short form, in the words of the tax authority. And that is, we itemize. We itemize. In the morning, we don't just say, Baruch Hashem, we woke up in the morning. No. You spell it out. You spell it out. Pokeach Evrim, Malbish Aramim, Matir Asurim, Rokar Etzalamayim. All of these brachot are different stages of getting up in the morning. Which you say, okay, I got up in the morning. But when you got up in the morning, you did this, that, this, that, this, that. You thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for everything. Because if you don't have the ability to do any of these, you're a little bit handicapped, you're in trouble. I remember last year when I had the slip disc and I couldn't walk for a few weeks. So the first time I really, really was able to put my foot down and walk, the bracha of HaMechin Mitzadei Gavra, put your shoe on and walk. And some people delay that bracha on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur until after the Tzom, because we don't wear shoes. So some people don't make that bracha until the end of the Tzom when they put their shoes back on. HaMechin Mitzadei Gavra, you're taking his first step. Now baby, you know, when baby takes the first step, everybody takes pictures and everything, you film it, it's an exciting moment. And it is an exciting moment, even if you have 25 grandchildren, you know, it's an exciting moment. But every day in the morning, get up and walk. Well, some people can't get up and walk. And you have to appreciate the fact that you can get up and walk. And then, kol tipa v'tipa, that's what the Rav said. And every drop, you have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then the Gemara says that you don't just stay the Birkat Hodaya when it starts drizzling. But there has to be a really, really serious rain that creates puddles to the extent that when the drops come down with such force, they bounce up, they rebound, and they meet the drops coming down. Kechatan hayotzei likrat kala. That's what the Gemara says. You know what that means? That there is actually a source to what many non-religious weddings, the chatan v'kala, do. And in the traditional weddings, you don't see this at all, except that what the non-religious people are doing is really a source, sourced from the Chazal. And that is, what most of our weddings are, you know, chatan is brought to the chuppah, and then they bring the kala to the chuppah, and then she does the ring around. But many times in the non-religious, they try to do things a little differently. And if they're going to have already a badekin at all, they do it when the kala comes down the aisle and then stops in the middle, and the chatan comes off the chuppah, comes down, and puts the hinoma over, and then together they walk up to the chuppah. That's exactly what Chazal said. Kechatan hayotze likrat kala. And the chosen goes out to meet the kala from the chuppah. And that's what the Gemara says. Just like when the Chatan goes out to meet the Kala, when the drops, it's so strong the rain that there are puddles, and the impact causes drops to pop up, to jump up, and they meet the other ones coming down, that's when it's time to say Hallel to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for rainfall, not for a little bit of a drizzle. And it just so happens that since I fully appreciated that Gemara, many times when I sit with Chatan V'Kala and try to engineer their chuppah, because I don't believe in what's called shablona. Shablona means a mold, that everybody's going to do it the same way. I think it's their own chuppah, and there should be some unique parts of within the framework of halacha. And I put on the table, you know, multiple versions of minhagim, and just pick and choose according to their feelings, and people really appreciate that. This is one of the things that I'm beginning suggesting to them, if they're interested, because I say it has a basis to it. And sometimes the audience is yes, sometimes no, but that doesn't make a difference. Okay, last week we began this page on science in Rambam's Mishnah commentary. So I'm just going to give you a sneak preview. And next week, as we will be towards Parshat Vayishlach, we're going to get a shiur in genetics, in how Yaakov Avinu figured out how he's going to walk away with the flock of his father-in-law Lavan by employing very sophisticated genetic information. And believe me, I wasn't the one who figured this out. You'll see next week, this was a school project in Israel in a non-religious high school. A non-religious high school worked this out, and using the Parshat HaShavua of next week, a sensational piece of science and Torah. And I say it, I'll repeat it next week again, you know, matov chalkenu manim goraleinu, that even in a non-religious setting, here in Eretz Yisrael, the involvement in Tanakh in general, and Torah specifically, even without being observant or fully observant, it's light years ahead of their counterparts, in Chutz Laretz. Their counterparts, I said this once in the army when I was And Tisha B'Av in a base where most of the Chevra were not dati, and I just took a peek at 6 p.m. to see who was going into the dining room for dinner about 2 hours before the end of the fast, hardly any Chayalim or Chayalot. And then for Mincha, the place was jam-packed, and everybody came to Mincha, and the guys asked for tefillin, and they fasted, and I gave them a talk between Mincha and Marif. I said, you know, a fellow in your religious standing, wherever you are now, in America, forget about the fact that he's not fasting. He doesn't even know it's Tisha B'Av. It's a completely different world. So that's what we'll deal with that next week, okay? The science in Rambam's Mishnah commentary. Last week I mentioned that I came on to this whole subject because of an incident when I was 11th grade, and we had a Rebbe who suggested that the Rambam started studying secular matters, secular studies, right, when he was 50 years old and beyond, which was utter nonsense. And I learned a great educational lesson from that. If you don't know, don't say. You know, like, and Chazal said it beautifully, Lemad Lishoncha Lomar Eini Yadea. Train yourself to say, I don't know. It's nothing embarrassing for a teacher in front of the class to say, I don't know. Nothing embarrassing for a parent to do that. The educational thing to do is to take the kids in the hand and take them down to a library or a Beit Midrash and figure it out together. Teach them how you would figure it out, that answer. So today it's easy. You just call up Rabbeinu Google Shlita, and more often than not, you'll get the answer. But if you want to do this a little bit more in-depth and scientifically, so you have to go through the various research techniques that are available. The Rambam was a scientist from day one. I mentioned last week, his earliest book that he wrote was a dictionary in terms of logic. He was 16 years old. And 23 years old, he writes the Mishnah commentary. It takes him 7 years to write it. And there I have a list at home of over 60 references of science. And we have on the page here, I think, 18 sources of some of these references. So last week we did the first side. So we're going to begin with the second side, source number 9. We just touched on it at the end of the shiur, but I wanted to just deal with it a little bit more in depth, because I have family interest in this. My wife is an audiologist. At Hadassah, she's the head of the cochlear implant department at Hadassah, and I have my baby daughter is an audiologist, and she also deals with these things. So I've heard quite a lot at home about audiology. Whether I like to hear about it or not is of no consequence. But sometimes you listen because of Shalom Bayit. And you just have to learn how to nod at the appropriate times. Well, my wife is very good. She says, I know you're not listening, but just keep listening, right? Somebody comes home after a long day of work and wants to spill it out. Tell me whatever you want to tell me. But there are subjects that are immensely interesting, and not just interesting, but also affect halakhic positions, and specifically with regard to the cochlear implant. Not only are there Shabbat issues with hearing aids, with battery and switches, and don't ask what, there are all kinds of issues. There are issues about fulfilling mitzvot that require hearing, whether it's Megillah, whether it's Shofar, and then the status of someone who hears, who's hearing impaired, but is able to hear through some type of device. The question is, what is the status of that person? And if it's questionable, then can you have that person be the Bal Korei to read the Megillah, the Bal Tokea, to blow the Shofar? These are the very serious halakhic issues. I would just tell you that with regard to cochlear implants, the issue is very different than hearing aids. And many Rabbanim believe today that a person with a cochlear implant, even if born completely deaf, not hearing impaired, completely deaf, does have a halakha of someone who hears and understands, and therefore would be competent to blow shofar in a shul for others. This I heard years ago already from one of my great teachers, Rabbi Tendler, and subsequently there was a ENT specialist here in Shalayim, Dr. Brahma, who wrote an article in Tchumin on this and came to the same conclusion. And just about 4 years later, the great Rosh Hashiva from Malei Adumim, Rav Nachum Rabinowitz, came up with the same conclusion, wrote a great article in Tchumin himself. You'll always have someone. Usually, I'm not saying this in a denigrated way, but usually in the Haredi world, they're going to say, no, maybe not. To say maybe not is many times predicated on, well, we don't exactly know what this is all about, so let's just be on the safe side. But the Gemara says, kochad de hetera adif, the koach, the strength of the one who permits is stronger, because the one who gives the permissibility, the lenient opinion, has to justify it. The person who gives the strict opinion can say, I'm not sure. So therefore, look, we're talking about a mitzvah of Shofar, which is a biblical mitzvah, Doraita. So why chance it and have somebody who himself might not be obligated? So why should that person be the Bal Tokea? Okay, that's a position that some poskim actually take. But as Rav Mital Zichron Brach always taught us, that the position of fulfilling all the opinions out there comes from weakness in being decisive. And if somebody who's a bold, courageous posek halacha knows how to be decisive, it's like so. What bracha do you make on French toast? Well, we're not sure. So take a piece of slice of bread and wash and make it feel sita. You make a moitzi. But what bracha do you make on French toast? Well, we don't know. So wash and take a piece of bread. But I don't want a piece of bread. I want to know what the bracha is on French toast. You have to have an answer. The French toast, the pizza, all these things, And then, you come with the Rabbi Shazad, there are two slices and one slice, Kofi Asuda. I'm telling you one thing, Ramosh Feinstein, I'm sure, was never at a pizza shop. You never saw this. And you have to be decisive. You have to say what the answer is. And that's the hallmark of a great posek. So, with regard to hearing, this all takes us back to a Mishnah in Masechet Trumot. And there, the Mishnah tells us that there are five people who, if they separate the grain for the Kohen, which from a biblical point of view is a minuscule, to use the halachic term, mashahu, a minuscule, chita achat poteret et akri, even one grain of wheat, and everything is permissible, the rest is permissible. But Chachamim put on a percentage anyway, which is roughly 2%. I say roughly 2% because they said, if you're an average guy, give 2%. That's 1 out of 50. But if you're a stingy guy, you can give 1 out of 60. If you're a generous fellow, 1 out of 40. Fine, so Chazal gave a little bit of some leeway here. So that's why you say it's approximately 2% of what you give to the Truma. So too with Challah. Challah, not everybody who takes off Challah is it considered an Hafrashat Challah. So it says, Cheresh Yotev V'Katan, and a goy who takes off Truma, a goy who takes off Challah. Let's say Angel's Bakery has a non-Jewish person there working, and he takes off the Challah. Or perhaps you have a nice, wonderful, dedicated Filipinit at home, taking care, and somebody's baking Challah, and there's a dough, and the Filipinit, she's already Paskin and Shilas, which, by the way, happens, because They are acquainted with the halacha because they're in the Jewish home for so many years, so they know already what to do for basar v'cholov and so on. That doesn't mean they're the poisek, but they think they are. So they'll take off the challah also, and so on. There's no act of hafrashat challah of somebody who's not bound by the mitzvah. So it's not just a technicality. It's not just technicality of hafrashat challah, but there has to be a somebody who's mechuyav, who's obligated in the mitzvah. A goy that performs a brit milah. Let's say we have a doctor, non-Jewish, in the hospital. On the eighth day, the baby is born, and he does circumcision. Let's assume he does it, you know, exactly the way you saw a moyel do it, and so on, so on, so on. That baby needs hatafat dam brit. Still has to have some type of symbolic brit milah, like we would do for a ger, for a convert, if the person had a milah, a brit milah anyway. Why? Because a goy cannot perform the mitzvah of brit milah. It's as simple as that. So the fact is, a person may not be an Arel anymore physically, but he's an Arel halachically. So he has to have Brit Milah. I remember when the Rav was teaching this once, so I blurted out. This was bold, to blurt something out in the Rav's shir. But the Rav was kind to me because I was his driver, so he knew that if he reacted violently, he would have to walk home. So he was very kind to me, excessively kind. I quoted the pasuk by Avraham Avinu. It says, "Vayamol Avraham Avinu et Yitzchak beno, kasher tziva oto elokim." Why does the Torah have to add "kasher tziva oto elokim"? That means if the mila is not done as a result of the tzav haborei, there's no brit mila at all. So it sounds very homiletic, but the Rav felt it was very good, understanding of that pasuk. "Vayamol Avraham et Yitzchak beno ben shmonat yamim, kasher tziva oto elokim." Without the kasher tziva oto elokim, the vayamol is nothing. It's negated. So we know that giving challah and giving a truma of a non-Jew and a cheresh, a deaf, and that we're going to talk about who's a deaf, shoteh is somebody who does not have any intelligible wisdom and knowledge, and there's some type of retardation there of a serious nature, and katan simply means under bar mitzvah. And whether you can be brilliant, there's a thing called an ilui. An ilui is a brilliant yeshiva boy at 8 years old, and the Rav is an ilui. And somebody said, "What's the difference between an ilui and a gaon?" An ilui is a kid, and a gaon is an adult. That's all. The problem is that some of the iluyim never grew up, so they were still iluyim when they were mature adults. It means they didn't simmer down, and they were still wild. All right, but. So I remember the Rav at age 12 could have given a brilliant shiur why he was exempt from a certain mitzvah, right? As a cotton, because he knew all the views and everything. So that's the halacha. Cheresh, shoteh, v'katan, they cannot perform truma and they cannot perform challah. So who's a cheresh? So that's what we're getting into. So the Mishnah says cheresh, wherever it says cheresh, it doesn't mean hard of hearing. It means somebody who is a deaf mute. It means eino shomea ve'eino medaber. It does. That's what cheresh means. In all of the mitzvot or halachot that the word cheresh comes up, it means eino shomea ve'eino medaber. Because if he's a eino shomea, he doesn't hear, but he is a medaber, that's obvious that he has da'at. He has that. What's the problem with eino shomea ve'eino medaber, a deaf mute? He must probably never was educated because they didn't know how to teach him. This is way before Helen Keller. They didn't know how to teach him. They didn't know how to get to his brain. It could be he had an IQ of 150. But if he can't get to the brain, if he can't get to training the person, he's not going to know anything. So he's not going to know anything, he's not responsible. Not responsible, you can't have him do a mitzvah. Even though it's a technicality here, but nevertheless, it's a mitzvah. You have to have kavanah during the mitzvah, even if you're doing it as shlichut. This is one of the mitzvot, giving truma, giving challah, can be done with a proxy. I don't have to take off from an angel's lachmaniyah, because they did it for me. Somebody did it. And it's, the Hashgacha says, that hufreshu trumot masrot. Okay, that means somebody did it on my behalf. And that's legitimate. But a cheresh is eino shomea ve'eino medaber, was a deaf mute, so he has no knowledge, no awareness, and so on. So the Rambam tells us that it's very different that if a person was born with hearing, learned how to speak, and later in life, because of meningitis, he lost his hearing, or some trauma, lost his hearing, whatever it is, people lose hearing. Sometimes they don't even know why they lose their hearing. It's called sudden hearing loss, by the way. And you just go right away to the emergency room, and usually they give you steroids, and hopefully within 12 hours it comes back. Not always. But we've had, unfortunately, experience here in Piguim, in terrorist attacks, where somebody was not hurt, essentially, right? Everything, he looks at himself, there was an explosion, unfortunately there were some casualties, but he looks okay, he's not bleeding anywhere, and all of a sudden he said he can't hear. Now it wasn't because of, first of all, it could be he was so close, the boom itself, but maybe it wasn't the boom itself. Maybe psychologically, he's not hearing, or not seeing. You can have psychological blindness also. You know, take him to the hospital, and we can test somebody who with involuntary responses, whether he hears or not. How do you test an infant hearing if you suspect the infant is deaf? You can't say, lift up your hand when you hear the beep. You know, that's not going to work. So what do you do? So we have a gadget, a machine. It's called ABR. It means something. And audito something response. And it basically measures electric brain waves that are emitted from the brain when you hear. Imagine when you hear, every time you hear anything, you're giving off waves. You're giving off waves. And that those waves are measurable. It was developed by a professor, Chaim Sommer, who lives right here in Giv'at Mordechai. He's got the world patent on it. And he works in Hadassah. This is ABR throughout the world. And they don't do it for everybody because it's an expensive test. But they do it for somebody who's, let's say, a faker. This guy has a claim with Bituach Lumi that he's a work-related accident. He doesn't hear. Right, so you know that he's going to fake it, so you don't bother with the test. Okay, when you hear the beep, you know, raise your hand, and we'll do an audiogram on you. They can't do that because they know this. They suspect, so they'll give him ABR. That's all. You don't have to respond. They just measure. They give him sound. They measure the brain waves. They know if he can hear. Before ABR, my wife told me when she studied audiology back in Queens College in New York. So they were trained how to train somebody like a faker. So you know, all of a sudden you whisper into the microphone, you know, your zipper is open by your pants. All of a sudden he looks down and says, you just passed your test. All kinds of things. These are tricks of the trade, you know. But today you don't have to do that. So you just give the kid, the person, an MRI. ABR, an ABR, right. It's fine. But If you can determine, but such a person who knows how to speak is not considered disqualified from giving truma or challah. The Mishnah does say, if he has problems hearing, if he doesn't hear at all, even though he can speak, there's going to be a problem with the bracha. Because when you say a bracha, you're supposed to hear the bracha. You don't have to say it loud, you don't have to yell it. But it has to be loud enough that you yourself hear the bracha. You can't just mouth out a bracha. You can't say, not good enough. You want to drink water, you have to say a shako, you have to say it. You can whisper it, but it has to be audible, at least to your own ears. So somebody who's completely deaf is going to have a problem with the bracha of Asher Kitshando B'Zabetzivanu Al-Hafashat Truma or Al-Hafashat Chala. He's going to have a problem making that bracha because he can't hear. So the din is, the halacha is, that someone else should do it on his behalf because of the bracha. That's like a side issue. But let's assume he did it anyway. He took off the challah, he took off the truma. It's bona fide hafrashat truma and challah. It works. Because he's not the chiresh who the Mishnah said is out. Okay, so now the Rambam says, source number 9. Chiresh bil shoneinu. When we say chiresh, hu she'eino shomea, somebody who cannot hear, the karu chachamim aleihem shalom, and our chazal said, lemi shelo shomea velo medaber, chiresh. Only a deaf mute is a chiresh. Lefi shesibat ha'ilmut, the reason why he cannot talk, he chershut shenifga ba hayeled b'me'imo. When he was still in utero, there were developmental issues that did not allow this baby to come out as a hearing human being, and therefore goremet lo shelo yishma eich medabrim. Now this, the Rambam, is hundreds of years before Western medicine in understanding how human beings learn to speak, and that it's imitation of sound of the mother, of the father, of the siblings, of the surroundings. If you cannot hear, then you'll never be able to imitate those sounds. That's why when if a baby at 5-6 months is not going goo goo and gaga, there's something wrong. So goo goo and gaga are not words, but they are the beginning of imitation of sounds. And what the baby ultimately does, the brain puts everything into its proper box of where the goos go and where the gas go, and then puts it all. The brain is unbelievable. And I don't think we understand more than 10% of the brain yet, by the way. Ask a good neurologist who's top, and he'll tell you how little of the brain we really, really know. And we know a lot about the brain today. We're learning all the time. We know so much that we know that there's so much more to learn. There's so much more to learn. That's what the Rambam said about knowledge. He says the person who's a real chacham is the one who knows how much he doesn't know. Because the person who doesn't know anything knows everything. Right? It's those people who know-it-alls. All the know-it-alls. So you know right away they don't know a thing. But the person who with great humility thinks that there's just so much more to know, that's a Talmud Chacham. That's why Rabbi Chanina said, "Harbei lamadati mi rabotai yoter mi chavirai umi talmidai yoter mi kulam." I learned from my students because I get new things. I get new input from another generation, from a young mind, and so on. The Rebbe used to love it if somebody in shir would ask him a crackerjack question that would destroy his whole shir. I'm telling you. Yeah.
Einstein said that the difference between someone who's a genius and someone of limited ability is infinitesimal compared to all that's unknown.
Yafeh. So here you have a situation where the Rambam is giving us an understanding of how deafness occurs in the newborn baby. It doesn't occur, it's just that the hearing never developed properly. Now, it could be many different things that didn't develop. There's an auditory nerve. There's hairs in the middle ear. That's in the cochlea. That's the cochlear, where it looks like a cochlear, and so on. There are different things that could have gone wrong in the development of the embryo that ultimately causes that this baby does not hear. And Rambam says, if the baby comes out and this world does not hear, then that baby's not going to be able to speak. And he says, "Ukvar nitba'er ze b'sefer hashelot ha'tiviot." And again, he refers to the material, the sources. The Rambam has available all that's been written on all these subjects, and he's read them. He's 23. By the time he's up to Masechet Truma, so he's 24 years old already. He's read all this, and he's giving you the source material. Ulefikach karu et ha'ilem al shem goreim ha'ilmut. That's why the mute is called the chereish, because what causes the muteness, the fact that he can't speak, is the deafness. That's why it's called the chereish. Veda she'im nitchareish ha'adam achreish haya shomea, if a person loses his hearing after he was able to hear, o ne'elam la'achrei shaya medaber, or he's not able to speak, like a stroke. I mean, it left the Lubavitcher Rebbe 2 years without the ability to speak. Hareza lo yitrom l'chatchila. L'chatchila, he shouldn't give truma because of the bracha problem. But the bracha problem is a side issue here. You know, you say a bracha, you have to hear it, as I mentioned. So, but that's a side issue. But in fact, if you do give truma, such a chereish who doesn't know how to speak, such a chereish who was born as a hearing person, the truma is valid and the chala is valid. So you have here a very, very interesting insight. When I showed this to my wife many years ago, she said, "Wow, this is really amazing that he really put his finger in one sentence and he really made the distinction between different types of deafness and so on." And now we have source number 8. Source number 8, you know what, I'm going to just jump for source number 17 because we're already on the subject of Masechet Trumot. So even though it's a different issue, but we're going to a different issue anyway, so we'll do 17 and 18. And that's called Balshanut. Balshanut means linguistics. So Rambam was also into linguistics. So I always refer to Avshalom Kor as Moriv Rabbi Balashon. He doesn't know who I am, but I know who he is. And I've met him a few times. A very pleasant fellow. I've seen him in the Chidon Tanakh. And remember when we had a boy in our class who made it to the final on the Yom HaSmut. He actually came in second, and he wasn't the champion, but he came in second. He used to live in Ramot, but then they moved to Chashmonaim. A very nice boy. So the family gets 4 tickets. In those days it was in the Jerusalem Theater. The family gets 4 tickets. The father, the mother, and then maybe 2 siblings, 2 friends, but they get 4 tickets. Don't ask me how I got 28 tickets and brought in the whole class. As I always say, if you know the right people, who needs protection? I went from government to government office, schnar two tickets here, schnar two tickets there. I mean, these people, they get the tickets, they don't go. And I knew it. I had some, you know, I had some pull in the various offices. I had 28 tickets. I brought the whole class. So when this boy's name was announced, they got up and started yelling, mayor, mayor, mayor. Avshalom Kaur goes, Chevra mechashmonayim, tiragu, take it easy, take it easy. Chevra mechashmonayim. So we got top billing on that. Yeshiva was now, as I mentioned, Chevra mechashmonayim. It's very nice. So he's an absolutely wonderful linguist. I have his book home called Yofi Shalivrit, and it's basically a synopsis of some of his radio broadcasts. And he was able to show that in a 30-second or 60-second spot, you can teach so much. He would have that on TV also occasionally for 2 minutes and teach a word or a phrase. And it was really gewaldic. It was really, really terrific. So once in the Mamlachti Dati school in Ramot Aleph, they brought him as a call it a lecture, but not a lecture, to do a program with parents and students. And it was just a lot of fun. But he said he was going to do family names. Okay, family names. So he asked the principal to send him up front the school list of students and faculty. So he gets an idea of which names he's going to use. I was not officially a member of the faculty, but I was like the advisory rabbi in the neighborhood. So my name was on there also. Okay. So he did homework, because he gets up and he starts with his first question. Is, he says, what's the connection between two names, Adler and Soloveitchik? And everybody's laughing. What's he talking about? Like, everybody knows that, you know, that I quote the Rav and all that, but where does Avshalom Kaur know? He's a man, a shrewd guy, and he interviewed some people and so on. Of course, the connection was that both are birds. Adler in German is an eagle, but that I knew. But I didn't know that Soloveitchik is a nightingale. A nightingale. It's a Russian name. And in Hebrew, there was a professor of the Supreme Court here in Israel, Yitzhak Zamir. Zamir is a nightingale. His name, he was born Soloveitchik. And he Hebraicized the name to Zamir. And then Avshalom Kaur said that the Tunisian Jewish community also have a Zamir, but they don't call it Zamir, but it's Twito. And Twito is the sound that comes out of the bird. Tweet, 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 tweet. So the name is Twito. So Twito and Zamir and Soloveitchik, it's all one name. That's amazing, right? I mean, we know that the one who founded Kfar Etzion in 1943 was Holtzman. Holtzman, Ish Eitz, Etzion, from the word Eitz. I mean, he was fabulous, absolutely fabulous. He just took all the names, whether they were places, whether they were professions, whether they were Kohanim and then variations, Kohen, Kohan, Kahana, right? And Katz, which is Kohen Tzedek, and then the variations and expansions, Katz, Katzman, Katzenstein, Katzenellenbogen, all these are all Katzes, and they're all Kohanim. And then it went over to Kaplan, which was a variation, and then Kaplan became Chaplain, like in Charlie Chaplin. So Charlie Chaplin was a Goyish Kohen. He was a Kohen, but he was a Goy. His father and mother wasn't Jewish. But he came from a Kahuna stock, Charlie Chaplin. Chaplin was Kaplan, Kaplan was good. That's where it came from. Kaplansky, they're all Kahanim. They're all Kahanim. So this, then with Levy also. So it was Levy, and there was Levine, and Levinstein, and Bill Clinton's girlfriend, Levinsky. And yeah, she was also a Goy, by the way. Father was a Levy, Nebuch. Levinsky. So there's a Bal Shanut, it's called, Bal Shanut. So here the Rambam was also into linguistics. So you look at source number 17, he takes the word Taram, Taf Resh Mem. So when you say Taram in modern Hebrew, what do you mean? What? No, Taram is with a tet. Taram is with a tet. Donation, correct. So you can say, I donated, taramti, you donated, taramta, taramt, taram, tarama, etrom, I will donate. It means donation. And I remember there was a commercial on radio for blood donations that started with a little jingle. It was taram, tam, tam, taram, tam, tam. And it really was taramti, dam, taramti, dam, taramti, dam. Because you didn't hear it at the beginning because the woman was singing taram, tam, tam, taram, tam, tam. And you didn't realize that she was singing taramti, dam, taramti, dam, taramti, dam. I gave blood, I gave blood, I gave blood. So taramti is a word in modern Hebrew. So the Rambam says, by the way, it's not a Tanachic Hebrew. Really? Isn't there a word Truma? Parshat Truma, Vezota Truma? Says that's a completely different word. The word Truma in Parshat Truma, where it says it over and over, by the way, the Shoresh, the root is Resh Vav Mem, which means uplifting, Rum. And the idea is that when people gave to the Mishkan, they parted with their own belongings, it was an uplifting experience. That's what Truma meant in the Chumash. That's what it means. Chazal then used the word that which was given to Beit HaMikdash or to poor people, whatever it was, is a, they made it into a noun, into a Truma. But that Truma is not the Truma of Parshat Truma. It's a different word. They made it into a noun that has a Shoresh, Taf Resh Mem, that does not exist in Tanakh. The root Taf Resh Mem does not exist in Tanakh. But then Chazal started using it. Chamisha lo yitromu v'im tarmu trum ein trum matan truma. In the same one line of the opening Mishnah of Masechet Trumot, the word is found four times. Chamisha lo yitromu v'im tarmu ein trum matan truma. And this is the verb taf reish mem, an invention of our chachamim. So Rambam comes along with a very, very big chidush, novel idea, that which our Chachamim have integrated into the Hebrew language from other languages or different grammatical forms into the Hebraic language become part and parcel of Lashon Kodesh. Now, does anybody have any idea how much of foreign language is in modern day Hebrew? It's a 20%. One out of five words in our language, it's a tremendous amount. Tremendous amount of milim loaziot, foreign words that have integrated the language. Now we have an institute, a government-sponsored institute, to protect the purity of the Hebrew language. And basically, they're scholars in linguistics, and they're supposed to make up new words that will correspond to new inventions and so on. So for example, you know, there's a word for television, but nobody uses it. Nobody uses it. Everybody's just happy with the televisia. And there's a word for radio, but nobody uses it. We're happy with the word radio. But the word for telegram, mivrak, that's Hebrew, because it comes from the word barak, which means a flash, a lightning bolt. And they used to refer to a telegram in the 19th century as sending a flash. I'm sending a flash. So that word, mivrak, from the word barak, became accepted. So if you send a telegram, you're sending a mivrak. But with regard to radio and television, the words that were suggested by this government-sponsored organization, institute, it just never made it. Like a telephone. Telephone, we use the loazi, we call it telephone. And then we conjugate it as such, tilpanti, atalpain, I will call, right? You use the word telephone, afaxes, I will send a fax, right? Afaxes, fixfasti, I send a fax. The word fax is now being used. By the way, the word fax itself is an abbreviation of facsimilia, right. So it was discovered. I saw this in the Mariv article 20 years ago here in Israel, that they discovered an unpublished manuscript of a Jules Verne a science fiction novel. Nobody knew about this at all, unpublished. And it was about a machine that's able to send things over, documentation, from place one to place two. And the name of the book was Facsimilia. It's unbelievable. The man was a Navi. Mamash, because that's exactly what a fax does. So we use that word fax in the Hebrew, and we just as a slang almost, and we use it, and that's the way it is. So the irony is that the Government Institute for the Protection of the Hebrew Language is called Ha'Akademia L'Lashon Ha'Ivri. The word academia is Greek. The word academia, academy, is Greek. So if they would have called it Ha'Machon L'Lashon Ha'Ivri, that would sound better. But these are academicians. And if you ever listen to a professor speak, a professor, to sound even more with it as a professor is more and more foreign phrases. You want to show how much you know foreign languages and so on. You show off. So they're not going to have the Machon L'Lashon Ivri. It's the Academia L'Lashon Ivri. And they're there to protect the purity of the Hebrew language. So the Rambam says in Source 17, Amarnu b'chol ha-mishnah, throughout Mishnayot, Taram, Vitoreim, Vyitrom, different forms of the Taf Resh Mem verb, Shoresh root. Makshim alav abal shenim achadashim. There's some new linguists here that ask questions about the use of this. Ve'omrim, and they say, Shaikar, Heirim, Meirim, Yarim. The word truma is Resh Vav Mem, which means uplifting. Ve'no kasha be'emet. Ram says, I don't have a problem with this. Why? Kivan Shaikar b'chol lashon, Choser l'mashe dibru bo ba'alei oto lashon v'nishma mehem. You know what language is? Language is what people use. And if people use it, it's language. It's legitimate. You can say that, you can go even so far to say even some slang. You know, to some countries that, you know, slang is inadmissible. It has to be pure. Vritiknit, you know, Queen's English or King's English, whatever. It has to be perfect and so on. But not to introduce the slang. But, you know, Donald Trump doesn't think that that has to be so when he speaks. You can have slang and other things. Ve'ilu b'li safek, ve'ilu b'li safek, ivriim ba'artzam. Certainly they were Hebrew people in the days of Chazal. Kloma b'eretz Yisrael. V'inei nishma mehem taram. They used the word taram, tafresh mem, as a giving, as a donation. V'chol mashu huf'al mehem menu, and everything that's conjugated from. He gave, she gave, they gave, we will give, and so on. Taram, taram, ti taram, etrom, and so on. This is clear in languages. It's something that's assumed in all the in the concepts of the Hebrew language. Any of the new guys coming on the new guys on the block that are asking, the Mishnah is not pure Hebrew because they have this there's a created words here, and they're using verbs that are not correct in any of the words. This is wrong. Because if the people use it, then it becomes a bona fide part of the language. And I am familiar with experts in Balshanut, in linguistics. I'm not talking about these upstarts, who think they know everything. They don't know what they're talking about. The Rambam says, I'm familiar with the linguistics in different languages. This is an acceptable mode of integrating words from different languages. Professor Daniel Sperva has a dictionary of Greek and Latin terms in Chazal. When you go through Mishnayot, Gemara, Babli, Yishalmi, and Medrash, you have all kinds of it. Take Sanhedrin. The word Sanhedrin, it's a Greek word, Sinhedrion. So Sinhedrion was a gathering of elders. Gathering of elders, which in Eretz Yisrael they refer to the Beit HaGadol, which is the Hebrew equivalent, as the Sanhedrin. The word Sinhedrion then grew into the word synagogue. And synagogue means gathering also. It's also a gathering of people for tefillah and so on. But it also led to the word in Latin, which then became in English and others, Senate. So what's a Senate? It's also from the word Sinhedrion. It means a gathering of elders. So obviously, you know, the rules of the Senate of Rome and the rules of the Senate of the United States may be different, but it's the same word. The same word. And synagogue and Sinhedrion and so on. So you have Greek words in the Chazal that are Afikoimen. Afikoimen could also be a Greek word, by the way. And others. There are plenty of words. I mean, it's a whole dictionary of Latin and Greek terms in Chazal. One of the greatest experts in this, specifically in Greek, was Rav Professor Shaul Lieberman, Zichron Levracha. In his Tosefta Kipshuta, you can see a man who was just a baki, was an expert in the classical languages. Today, nobody's really interested to studying classical languages. You know, you can't make a living if you happen to know classical languages, yeah.
But the kids do on the internet, they have a whole new language. They just cut off half of the word all the time.
Right. Or they make up language. You know, there's a language called Yeshivish. Right? So Yeshivish is a cross between poor English and Yiddish and Lishna d'Rabbanan, Gemara Lashon. That's what it is. That's what Yeshivish is. It's poor English. I have never heard somebody who speaks Yeshivish speak proper English. I remember when at YU several years ago, they asked me a few times when I was visiting in the States to talk to the smicha students about rabbinic and educational opportunities here in Eretz Yisrael, which I was very happy they were even interested, to expose the guys to what's available here in Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Lamb, when he was then president of the yeshiva, he asked me, so what do you tell them? I said, first thing, they should really perfect their Ivrit, because that's their tools, you know. So he said, did you tell them they should perfect their English also? Wouldn't hurt. Yeah.
While we're on the topic of this, I noticed earlier, when you said shofar, you didn't say shofar. You said
shofar.
Where does that oim come from?
Oim? From Galicia.
Yeah.
My Hasidic background.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so. The O sound is a variable in different locations. In Lita, it's a Schaefer. It's a Schaefer. In Germany, it's a Schaufer. It's an Au, the umlaut. Right. In America, it's a Schaufer. It's an O. And in Poland, it was an Oi. Oi. Right. It's like, I always tell people, if you're using Waze to get somewhere and they take you into a non-desirable neighborhood, you say, Oy Vez. So there's certain Oys. Shlomo Kalbach's Nagunim sometimes, they, you know, some good Oys. Oys is a good kvetch, you know. You don't say, oh, you know, that doesn't sound right. Oy. Right. Shoifa. Right. Shofar. Shofar. Right, so here in Israel, in Havaras Sfaradit, the Cholam sounds like a Komatz. Basically, it's right. That's basically what it is. And if it's a cholam, and it doesn't have the vav or just the nekuda of a cholam, but as a komatz, it would be a komatz katan, and it's pronounced as a o, not as a a. Like a lot of people say chachma. There's no such word as chachma in Hebrew. It's chochma, chochma, chochma. As I said before, vayamol. The mem is a komatz katan, so that's a o sound even in modern Hebrew. And a lot of chutznikim who have not learned proper digduk are not familiar with this, and it's just like the word kol, right? Kol olam kulo, kolot balevav. It's not kal, even though it's a kamatz, because it's the word kol with a dot. It's a cholam, but it's been in smichut. It becomes kol. And it's a yeshli kol kaf lamed is with a nukuda. It's a cholam. So it would be koil in America. If somebody would read it, it would say koil or karl in Germany, right? So, that when it comes, when the word kaflamet comes in smichut, in connection with another word, so it changes to a kol. But it's a kamatz katan, and it's pronounced as o, not as o, not as a. You don't say kal olam kulo. It's kol olam kulo. Kol olam kulo. What?
There are exceptions.
Everything, there are exceptions.
There is a note on the
kal. It could be because it's not besmichut. That's why. It's not besmichut, and it's b'chotzer. Okay, so that every rule has an exception, that we know. That's right, granted. Okay, so here you have this statement by the Rambam about the linguistics. It's very important. Just as a corollary to this, source number 18 is another context of linguistics, and it's from Masechet Brachot, the second chapter. It says, Perush Istanis. Istanis, the context was, the Mishnah, in a just a by the way, mentions that when one of the Tanaim was in Avelut, normally you know that Avel and Shiva is not allowed to wash. Again, if there's any particular Shaila that has to be asked, so Rav will answer the question when an Avel and how an Avel can wash during Shiva. That's not my job right now. But the basic halacha is that just like on Tisha B'Av, you don't wash, on during Shiva, you don't wash. I know this can present hygienic issues, and that's why a Rav should be in on the discussion. But it says that one of the Tanaim, Rami Gamliel, he did wash. After his wife died, he was in Shiva, he did wash. So they asked him, how can you do that? So he said, istanis ani istanis. So what does istanis mean? Usually translated as hypersensitive. So Rambam says istanis is actually a contraction of two words. Gufo mitsunan. His body is cold and he needed warm water. It wasn't so much the cleanliness that was at issue, but needed warm water just to warm his skin up a little bit. He says nigzar, the word istanis comes from two words. Min tsina. Min, from the word tsina, cold. Istanis, cold. Even though it's written with a samach, istanis, So where do you see the word Sina? You see Samach Taf Nun. Now Samach Tet together is Tz. Right? Samach Tet. Try to say a Samach Tet together. It would be Tz. You get the Samach and the Tet. So it's a Tzadik sound. So even though it's written with a Samach, it's really from the word Sina. And Sina means cold. It means cold. V'zeh Matzui Barbei Safot. And this kind of assimilation of sound, of articulation, is known. Here, talk to any speech therapist, and they'll tell you exactly what the Rambam is talking about here. Because many times, there are kids, and sometimes adults, but you know we try to catch it while they're kids, so we can correct it. They say certain words, and they have a lisp. And let's say one particular letter. There's now a commercial going on, which I can't stand, about this woman who tells us why she's promoting this particular product that has all the samachs. Because she apparently has a noticeable lisp on the samachs. So they got her specifically because the product has a lot of samachs in it and so on. You'll hear it on radio if you're listening to it. So the Rambam says that, yes, there's a... The sounds do sound similar, and therefore they can be exchanged in writing. I'll give an example that sounds a little bit funny. But, you know, the Sfaradim eat kitniot on Pesach. Right? That's the way to go, right? Yeratzon shekulanu Sfaradim. But Moroccan Jews don't eat hummus on Pesach. So why don't they eat hummus? Hummus, what's the problem with hummus? It's also kitniot. Because hummus sounds like chometz. That's the reason. Now, one second, hummus has a samach at the end, chometz has a tzadik at the end, but it sounds the same. Sounds like the same. What about chometz? You know, vinegar we use. Kasher, you know, we use chometz on Pesach. Get kosher le Pesach chometz, vinegar for Pesach. But the Moroccans maybe didn't have vinegar. Maybe if they would have had vinegar, they wouldn't have used it either. But the chomus they don't eat because it sounds like chomets. It's the samach tzadik interchange, which is exactly what the Rambam's talking about here, about istanis. And what's interesting is that many of the modern day poskim have actually adopted this idea. This where Rav Gamliel is talking about that he's an istanis, that he's hypersensitive, and therefore he was mater. He permitted himself to wash during the week of Shiva. So, you know, there was a saying here in Israel many years ago, Baruch Hashem today, it's really, really changed amongst Israelis, that they take a shower once a month whether they need it or not. That has really changed. And because in modern days, the awareness of hygiene behavior is so much more upgraded than it ever was before, we all have a din of istinis when it comes to these halachot. That's why, let's say, in the nine days, especially in a summer, if it's sweltering heat and so on, you know, not to change clothing, not to wash yourself, to wash it down. You know, by the fifth day already, before Tisha B'Av, you're not allowed to go into shul anymore because of the odor. So no, I'm serious about this. So the heter, the permissibility of washing, so, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, you stand in a shower for half an hour and enjoy yourself. Because what really was asur was rachatza shel tanug, pleasure bathing. And this impacted also with summer camps, with kids. So some of the poskim, like Rav Moshe Feinstein said, you know, you have for the kids under bar mitzvah, swim instruction. You know, it was under the guise of swim instruction. You got to get them in the water a little bit, and it would be unhealthy if they didn't do that, and so on. So this all stems from this case of istanis, where once upon a time he was unusual, he was istanis, but today it's far from unusual. Everybody has the halacha of being istanis in this particular area of hygiene. But okay, so the Rambam uses this for purposes of Baal Shanot as well. Let's just go now to the issues of astronomy. There are just two more issues left. One is source number 9. Source number 10, rather, on top in the third of the page, on the second side, again. So we know that there's sunrise and sunset, right? Besides being a song in Fiddle on the Roof, it also has halakhic connotations. Because the morning starts in the sunrise and ends at sunset. Yes, according to many poskim, like the Vilna Goyim. But there are poskim who say that the day really begins slightly before the sunrise and ends slightly after the sunset. So what we call Amud HaShachar, and we call Tzeta Kochavim. So with regard to Shabbat, we play it safe. We begin Shabbat from sundown, but we don't end Shabbat until Tzeder Kochavim. So technically Shabbat should be exactly 24 hours. But it isn't. Shabbat is always 25 hours. Or 24 and a half, whatever it is. Wherever you have to look at the calendar. But we always extend it a little bit. And the reason is because Shabbat is Doraita, so we're machmer on both ends, on both of the views. Now, so too with regard to mitzvot that you do in the morning. So let's assume taking lulav for shofar, right, on Rosh Hashanah. So these are mitzvahs for the morning, for the daytime. If a person blew shofar before sunrise, but after Amud HaShachar, so b'di'avad, he fulfilled his obligation. But he really should be doing it after sunrise. That's for sure. And so on. And then with regard to other mitzvot as well. So what is this Amud HaShachar? So Rambam tells us that it's astronomically calculated. In source number 10, Amud HaShachar means Amud Ha'or HaBokeh HaBoker. It's the first ray of light that is visible as the night comes to an end, the beginning of morning. V'or Yira'eh B'pa'at Mizrach. You see it at the edge of the eastern horizon. Kodem Alot HaShachar, before sunrise. Kisha'a Ve, there's a mistake here, it's V'chomesh. The ration the computer missed. It should be a shin. Shabbat Chomesh, an hour and a fifth. So what's a fifth of an hour? 12 minutes. So you must probably heard of 72 minutes before sunrise. This is the 72 minutes. 60 plus 12 is 72 minutes. Kishabah Chomesh min ha-sha'ot ha-shavot. What does sha'ot ha-shavot mean? Equal hours. That if the sunrise was 6 in the morning and the sunset was 6 at night, so now we're talking about an hour and 12 minutes before, which would be 4:48 a.m. Exactly. Except that doesn't always happen. It rarely happens that the morning sunrise is exactly at 6 and the sundown is exactly at 6. In the spring and in the fall, indeed, your daytime and nighttime are approximately 60 minutes each hour. But in the summer and the winter, in the northern hemisphere, your daytime hours shrink to 50 minutes an hour. If you divide the time from sunrise to sunset by 12, and you only have 10 hours of sunlight and 14 hours of night, so your halachic hour is going to shrink in the morning and expand at night. And in the summer, bidyuk hafuch, just the opposite. You're going to have a longer halachic hour in the daytime and a shorter halachic hour at night. And it's to these halachic hours that you have to then go back to sunrise and pin in where the halacha says that 3 hours, 4 hours, 5. That's what it means. It doesn't mean 60 minutes. Right now in the winter, it could be 50 minutes. So if halachic hour is 50 minutes, and sunrise, let's say, for argument's sake, was, let's say, 6:30 in the morning. So you have to, and the end of Kriyat Shema time is 3 hours from the morning. So you take 3 times 50. 3 times 50 is 150 minutes. 150 minutes is 2.5 hours on the clock. So you go from 6:30 until 9 o'clock in the morning, and that would be the end of Kriyat Shema. You'd say, 1 second, it doesn't say 3 hours, it should be till 9:30. No, but it does. It's not the 60 minutes on the clock. It's 60 minutes halachic hours. And that's why you have to have a calendar to know what the halachic hours are. And that's why there are no 2 days that are identical in terms of the exact time that you can begin putting on talis and tefillin, the exact time you can finish reading Kriyat Shema and davening, and when you can start davening mincha. I mean, sometimes it's 2-3 days in a row where it's the same, especially if it's in transition. Like right now, for at least a week, you can daven mincha at 11:52. But then it's going to start moving to 11:53, 11:54, and so on. Of course, my son Yehuda, who's a computer specialist, so he developed an application, an app, called Jewish Clock. And if every one of you can download this on Google Store, called Jewish Clock, and you get the whole explanation in English of everything I just said now in a long Megillah, in 2 pages, signed by Yehuda Adler. And this clock is not a regular clock, right? It looks like, from the far, it looks like it's 8:20. No. The black part is the nighttime, the white part is the daytime, and here in Israel, the daytime is shorter than the nighttime, so the spread between each hour at night is much greater than in the daytime, and you know exactly how far you are from sunrise, how close you are to sundown. You don't have to have any calendar, and you can know when to, with last time to daven mincha, and so on. And this is a Sha'ot Zmaniot clock. He had asked me once when I took this, first time I downloaded it when I go abroad, to see if it works in different countries, because the location of the phone changes. And the answer is it did. It adapted. He wasn't sure what was going to happen. But even now in Australia, I was there 2 weeks ago, it worked. It's summer there, and it adapted to the summer location. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But, and he just did this. He did this for fun, by the way. Like he was twiddling his thumbs, and he did this application. So this is Shaul Zmaniyot. So this is what the Rambam says. Sibat kirvat shetach. Why does this happen? Why is there light already? Why doesn't the light start when the sun comes up? Why is there a glow? Basically, Amura Shachar means there's a glow of light. It's not direct sunlight. Because he says the sun hasn't really risen as yet, so you don't see the ball of the sun, but the rays of the sun are now projecting out to the atmosphere at a particular angle that now rebounds upon Earth, and you get that refraction of light, and that's what we're seeing. That's what he's saying. V'sibato, and its reasons is kirvat shetach hekif or hashemesh le'edim akvedim ha'olim min ha'aretz tamid shegovham al minei ha'aretz adama 51 mil. Something 51 miles, something makes a calculation of the angle of 72 minutes before sunrise, how this actually begins. Kemo shenit ba'er b'torat ha'mada'im. Just read the science books and you see where I got this from. Now this is really remarkable. He's able to make that kind of scientific understanding of what Amud HaShachar is all about. We have just a quarter of a minute because we're over time. And that has to do with Kiddush HaChodesh. Kiddush HaChodesh is astronomy. And in two sources, in Perish HaMishnah, Rambam's commentary, he promises us a book on the subject. Just look at sources 11 and 12 in Masechet Sukkah. Hadibur alinyan hariyah va'ibur, about sanctifying the moon and adjusting the leap years, the calendar, the solar and lunar calendar, should be a denu. I think I'm going to write a book on this. Most people don't have a clue what this is all about. I'll write a book. And source number 12, he repeats it in Masechet Rosh Hashanah. Rambam promises and never fulfills. Never wrote the book. But, in source number 14, the only source not from Perish HaMishnah, but from Mishnah Torah, Hilchot Kiddush HaChodesh, the Rambam gives us about 12 full chapters of astronomy, calculations, and he fulfills his obligation of writing the book, but he attaches it as an appendix to Hilchot Kiddush HaChodesh, and he ends it with this wonderful phrase. This is how it ends in the 19th chapter of Hilchot Kiddush HaChodesh. Harebiarnu cheshbonot kol adachim shetzurichim lahem. I explained all the calculations that you require biyidiyat hariya ubachakirata edim, in visually sighting the moon and interrogating the witnesses who would see it. Kedesh ye hakol yadua lemevinim. So anybody who's got a little brain on his head will understand this. He knows it's complicated. He knows not everybody's going to follow. But if you have a half a brain, you're with me. I'm going to present it. V'lo yachseru derech midarkei Torah. There should be nothing missing in the ways of Torah, because without this information, you're lost in terms of understanding the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh. V'lo yishotetu levakesh achreha b'sforim achim. I don't want you going to a strange library, because you're going to go to a library, who knows what other books you're going to find there. I'd rather stick it on as an appendix here in Hilchot Kiddush HaChodesh, in the Mishnah Torah. Here, this is it. You don't have to go anywhere. And the Chazon Ish wrote a whole commentary to this section of the Rambam Hilchot Kiddush HaChodesh, which shows what kind of a mathematical genius he was into trying to make some sense in this. Well, I just make one point that the Rambam, we know that there's a calendar truism that Rosh Hashanah cannot come out on the Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. Lo Adu Rosh. Everybody understands this as a convenience issue. That says Sof Maaseh Machshava Tchila. It's programmed so that Yom Kippur shouldn't come out on a Friday or Sunday. Shouldn't have 2 days in a row without the possibility of cooking. And that Rosh Hashanah Rabbah shouldn't come out on Shabbat. So if Rosh Hashanah doesn't come out Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday, so Hashanah Rabbah won't come out on Shabbat, and Yom Kippur will never come out on Friday or Sunday. That's the way we were brought up, that's the way we were taught. Rambam comes and tells us a story that from Sheshit Me Breshit, from Breshit Bara Elokim et HaShemayim et HaAretz, the first of Tishrei can never come out on a Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. And the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham ben David, he yells, he says, I don't understand. He says, I never went. Is there a...
How's the phone?
There's an air raid sign? Whatever that means. What does that mean? Okay, that's it. The red alert is over. Fine. We'll hear it's a false alarm. The nobody told me it was a war today, so.
The 4th of July.
The 4th of July. No, today's Kennedy's Yard Saint. So the rabbi says, you know, look, I didn't go to school. I don't know any of this stuff. That's what he says. He's sitting in southern France. I just know the Mishnayot. I just know that why we don't have Lo Adu Rosh and so on. But you see, the Rambam, you know, he was banking on scientific information even to explain that kind of detail in the laws of the calendar and how the Jewish calendar functions. So this is an interesting line of source number 13 from the Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh. The Rambam was a great scientist. Okay, so I said again, those who came in late, next week in Mitzvah Shem, for Parshat Vayishlach, we're going to do a nice shiur on genetics and try to understand how Yaakov Avinu really got the big flock out of the dotted sheep and from Lavan. All right. What was that? Right, a few years ago. I'll show you. I'll give you the